I'm caught up in the game. My attention is on every play and every whistle. But what I'm missing is a signal coming from my kidneys. That signal isn't like a ref's whistle. It's more of a silent SOS, which could be warning me of an increased risk for events like heart attack or stroke. And a way I can catch that signal? A simple urine test called UACR. If you have type 2 diabetes or high blood pressure, talk to your doctor about the UACR test. Detect the SOS. Visit detectthesos.com to learn more.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Get smoother, brighter skin instantly in one easy step. Dermalogica's Daily Microfoliant gives you the smooth, glowy skin you want without damaging your skin barrier. This gentle exfoliating powder activates with water to smooth out rough texture and brighten skin. It's powerful enough to deliver results, yet gentle enough to use every single day, even on sensitive skin. See the results for yourself. Visit Dermalogica.com and use code SMOOTH at cart for an exclusive free gift with $65 purchase.
This is Metroscope, an Entercom Portland Public Affairs program. I'm Preston Highfield. Joining us this time on Metroscope is Ryan Rittenhouse from Friends of the Columbia Gorge. Ryan joined Friends in 2013, and for 6 years prior to moving to Oregon, Ryan lived in Austin, Texas, love that town, where he worked as an environmental organizer and activist with Public Citizen and Greenpeace. He's a native of Cleveland, Ohio. He's also worked for Ohio Citizen Action and has spent months at sea volunteering for oceanic wildlife protection and conservation. Welcome, man. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And the people won't know this, but you have an outstanding beard going on right now. You told me it's been in the works for 6 months.
Well, I've had it for years, but yeah, it took about 6 months to grow it to its current state, and I've maintained it this way for 7 or 8 years now.
Do you know who Nat Borchers is of the Portland Timbers?
Vaguely, not well, yeah.
Okay, he's got a similar look going.
Yeah.
So for folks who want to put two and two together who are listening and can't see it, he's got that awesome beard going. Well, cool, man. Yeah, thanks for being here. I guess we just, let's start off with Friends of the Columbia Gorge and just what that is and what that organization is here locally and kind of what you guys do.
Absolutely. So Friends of the Columbia Gorge was formed in 1980, and its pretty much sole purpose at the time was to protect the Columbia River Gorge geologic area. And there was a lot of questions as to how to do that. Well, by 1986, they'd settled on the idea of a national scenic area and had gotten that passed through Congress. And Ronald Reagan a little hesitantly signed it. He wasn't really known as the biggest environmentalist in the world, but he did sign it and he got passed into law. So what exactly is a national scenic area? Well, there was one prior to the gorge getting set up, but it was a small one out in the middle of nowhere, California. I don't remember exactly where it is. And there have been a few more added since then, but there aren't that many scenic areas in the country. A lot of people wanted to make the gorge a national park, but there are 14, what we just a fancy word for town, mm-hmm. in the gorge. And, you know, name me another national park that has 14 towns in the middle of it. So that didn't really seem like it was going to work. A lot of the towns were really, really concerned with what would happen to their economies and everything else if the whole area around them got turned into a national park. So National Scenic Area was kind of a compromise because it allows us to set up a protected area all around these towns that makes overdevelopment untenable. And it preserves the existing uses for recreation or agriculture. And it also allows the urban areas to continue their own development without any hindrance from the scenic area whatsoever, as long as they don't try to go outside their urban area boundary.
Okay. So basically, folks, for everyone who loves hiking the gorge and wandering through nature, you guys are the great folks who help maintain that and conserve it.
Yeah.
In simpler terms, for people like me to understand.
Yes. And we are the place to go for all things gorge related. We continue to be the main watchdog group for the Gorge Commission, which is the regulatory body that was set up to enact the Scenic Area Act. And we continue to lead over 100 hikes and outings every year. So if you're interested in going out hiking in the gorge with other people, I know some people prefer to just go out on their own, but if you want to go with a group, we do over 100 hikes every year. And we usually, we always have them led by a hike leader who typically knows a lot about what you're going to see, maybe the wildflowers you're going to see, or maybe the historical aspects of what you're going to see on the hike. Mm-hmm. So it's really cool. You can just go to our website, gorgefriends.org, for more info. If you become a member, you get first dibs at all the hikes. So you get to, you get first sign up grabs at all the hikes. So definitely recommend people to become members. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, and almost all of our funding comes from individuals who just care about the gorge.
Cool. Gorgefriends.org is the website. I was on there earlier perusing. I was on the history section, and they did have that press clipping from the Oregonian, old school article. President Reagan signs bill, whenever it was, in the 80s or something like that.
Yeah, 1986.
Yeah, in 86. But yeah, no, that's cool, man. And I asked you earlier before we got on air how many hikes there are on the gorge, and you just laughed. You're like, this guy's probably such an amateur, because I've been on many. Or I shouldn't say, man, I probably hiked there 5-6 times in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
But, you know, you always just drive to where, for me, as like a total rookie hiker, I just drive to where the other cars are, and I'm like, oh, that one looks cool.
This looks good.
Like, this looks like a cool waterfall. I want to hike through that or swim through that. Yep. And then I just go. But is there a rough estimate of how many different hikes there are?
Oh, yeah. And I don't remember off the top of my head, but I want to say there's probably over 100 official trails out in the scenic area. You can go to our website again. We have detailed information on every single official trail that's out in the gorge. There's just a drop down at the top for hikes. It's going to have everything there you'd ever want. And all the detailed information on those pages not only tells you the name of the trail and where it's at, it tells you the elevation gain, the total distance, a sort of a generalized difficulty rating for the hike, whether it's family friendly and pet friendly, all that information. So, yeah, please do utilize our website if you want to go out hiking. It's the place to go.
Fantastic. Gorgefriends.org for those listening who want to check that out. So your official job title, I was looking on the website, is conservation organizer.
That's right.
I'm interested in how you kind of became interested and passionate about that subject, because it looks like in Austin you were doing something similar as an environmental organizer there as well.
Yeah, so I've been an organizer and activist focused on environmental issues for about a decade now. And I got my start, I was sort of thrown into the deep end of the pool. When I graduated college, my degree is in communications, and I did a lot of focus on theater and film work, but I wasn't really sure what to do. And, you know, it's not exactly the most stable industry for employment, so I wasn't always having full-time employment. And an opportunity landed in my lap. My stepbrother was on the board of directors of an oceanic conservation group called Sea Shepherd, and they were looking for crew members. They go out on the high seas, and they do direct action interference in illegal whaling and fishing activities. If you've heard of the show Whale Wars on Animal Planet, have you ever heard of
that? I love Animal Planet, but I haven't seen that.
Well, some of your listeners have probably heard of it then. That's Sea Shepherd, the people featured on that show. Kind of the extreme end of environmental activism, because they literally put themselves in the way between like harpoon ships and the whales. They'll get in dinghies and try to prevent, you know, Japanese whalers typically these days from shooting at whalers.
Wow.
And they've been doing it for decades. They did it back when the Russians were still whaling, and the Russians don't do much whaling anymore. But so they've been going strong. And I joined up one summer and back in 2005. And I sailed with them for almost a year, almost circumnavigated the globe. I went to Galapagos, where they do a lot of conservation work. And then we went across the Pacific and we're in Melbourne, which I told you a little bit earlier, for about a month and a half. Get on you. And saw a free Jamiroquai concert while I was there. And that was awesome. And then we were staging there and getting much more crew together so that we could go down to Antarctica and interfere with the illegal whaling activities that the Japanese are still doing to this day down there, unfortunately. And did that. And so that was amazing. It was incredible. And it was amazing as an environmental activist to see a direct impact from direct action like that. You know, you get to actually, I mean, there was a day where I saw a small family pod of gray whales go right by us. And we knew that they weren't going to die that day because we were there. And that's really powerful. And it was really moving and it really changed my life in a lot of ways. But the whole time I was down there, I kept thinking in the back of my head, there's this whole global warming thing going on.
Yeah.
And if we don't do anything about that, well, nothing Sea Shepherd's doing is going to have mattered, because all the whales will probably die anyway, because with global warming will probably come the collapse of krill and plankton, and that's the food that the whales need to survive. So so when I got back, I decided I either wanted to continue doing work in theater and film or do work in environmental activism related in at least some way to climate change. And so that's what I've been doing ever since. And in the past 7 to 8 years, it's mostly been the environmental side of things. Every now and then I get pulled into a film project, but it's mostly been, and especially paycheck comes from working for environmental groups. So,
yes, I know. Yeah. I know how that goes as someone getting my start out of college a couple of years here. But that's really cool, man. I didn't expect that story. That's I can imagine how that would kind of sway you to lean down that path to what you're on now and working in the environment. So as far as like, you know, our listeners, I think, would probably love to hear about the Gorge itself. And, you know, our listeners are in Portland and Southwest Washington. I mean, what do you guys, how do you help conserve the land and conserve the Gorge? I mean, what is that process like?
Oh, it could take the form of any number of things. I mean, we also have a land trust. A lot of people aren't aware of that, but we have a section of our organization that's a land trust, which means we buy land. We purchase it to preserve it and protect it. Usually we're doing that in order to then get the land kind of into a shape that's attractive for the public agencies that we would then sell it to so that it gets into the hands of the public. Sometimes that just isn't going to work out, though. People might be surprised to hear, but the public agencies, they're really picky about what land they'll decide to accept. Even if you wanted to donate it to them, they might not even want to accept it because of any number of criteria. So we're sort of a middleman sometimes in that regard between private landowners and public agencies in terms of getting land back into the public, you know, preserve. But we also just own land that we're probably going to keep holding on to for a while. One of the biggest, well, the biggest by far piece of properties we own is called the Lyle Cherry Orchard. Lyle's a town out almost towards Dallasport on the Washington side of the gorge. And there's a big old cherry orchard that was up on a bluff over there. There's no cherry trees left anymore. Well, there's one cherry tree left. but it's a nice, beautiful, amazing area, beautiful example of Eastern Gorge geology and habitat and ecosystems, and we're actually in the process of installing a new trail system out there too. So if you want to get out and you want to get away and get a less typical Western Gorge hike, especially since the Eagle Creek Fire still has a number of the most popular hikes in the West Gorge closed, like we were talking about earlier with the Eagle Creek Trail and Oneonta Gorge, they're still closed and will be for some time. A hike like the Lyle Cherry Orchard is a great alternative.
Okay. This is Ryan Rittenhouse from Friends of the Columbia Gorge joining us on Metroscope. And I think a lot of people would be curious about an update about, you know, restoration of that area that was affected by that Eagle Creek wildfire. It was obviously, to anyone who's been here in Portland, it was pretty devastating. I mean, certainly as someone who's, I've spent 24, 25 years here now, my whole life pretty much. I mean, what's the update on how the gorge is doing and how much of that area was actually affected and how much is being restored? It's kind of a big question, but I mean, I think a lot of people would love to hear kind of an update.
Sure. So, yeah, the fire was quite large, and it burned through the whole Eagle Creek Trail area, and that's where it started. That's why they called it that, because they usually name the fire after the region where it starts. But it burned all over. Sometimes it was burning east, sometimes it was burning west. Most of it, I believe, moved west. And it burned all the way to Multnomah Falls and even further west than that.
Wow.
And it was threatening. The winds shifted, and it was starting to burn again east as well. But then it died, and the weather kind of dampened it down. So it shut down a lot of, it didn't shut down overall a large percentage of the gorge, because the gorge is quite large. Mm-hmm. I mean, the National Scenic Area is both sides of that river, and it extends all the way from the border of Troutdale at Sandy River all the way out to the Deschutes east of the Dalles. So there's lots to see out there that wasn't impacted at all by the fire, but the area that was is some of the most heavily trafficked and most beloved trails in the gorge.
Yeah.
So that was pretty devastating for a lot of people. And the fire was also incredibly devastating for the locals who live in the area. And that's really where we need to focus, I think, in the future, is how do we make sure that the communities that live near fire-prone areas are most well-prepared, and do we have the things in place that we need to help them recover, not just from the fire itself, but the businesses that suffer losses in revenue from people not being around anymore. I mean, the fire happened at the height of their tourism season out there, and so it was a huge hit to the businesses in the area. But ecologically speaking, the fire actually wasn't that bad from an environmental perspective. And in terms of restoration, the forest is pretty much going to take care of itself. A lot of people, you know, it's funny because fire is so dramatic and it's so violent. We have this visceral reaction to it. But, you know, and so there is this kind of natural urge to put it out if you see it, right? But nobody talks about like putting out a hurricane or putting out a thunderstorm. And yet a wildfire is no more rare or strange to the natural world than either of those things is. So really it's about how do we live with wildfire and how are we going to live in concert with it? And how do we make sure that our forest practices aren't making this much worse? Because the sad truth of the matter is that practices like clear-cut logging and mostly any of the other disturbances that we do to our forests is what's making them more fire-prone. If you have a biologically diverse forest, if you have a forest that's allowed to get old-growth trees back in it, that's going to be the most resistant to wildfire, and that's what we should be pursuing.
I appreciate that. This is Ryan Rittenhouse from Friends of the Columbia Gorge joining us. Gorgefriends.org is their website. They have some cool events going on that they do and host during the summer that we'll get to in just a little bit. Was that fire was started by a kid with a firecracker?
Unfortunately, yeah. Yeah, it was, you know, we were coming off a few weeks or even months of drought, and that's all it takes sometimes. Yeah. It's just somebody, and I don't think they had ill will. I don't think they were trying to start a forest fire. They just were operating us, and you know, a lot of people don't realize, but all fireworks like that are illegal in Oregon. You're not supposed to be setting them off at all. If you want to see a fireworks show, there's going to be plenty of professional people doing that job.
Yeah.
And I encourage people to stick to that. I actually used to be a pyrotechnician, a licensed pyrotechnician at a Six Flags back in Ohio. So I love fireworks.
Yeah.
I just don't want people putting themselves at danger and putting, you know, wild areas and more importantly, people's homes and sure. in danger. It's also, if you do it in town, I personally have a dog that gets PTSD from fireworks.
Oh, man. Yeah.
So I plead with people in my neighborhood, please don't set off fireworks.
I do too. Yeah, I think that's every dog owner's worst nightmare is the 4th of July when you're like, okay, do we take this dog to the garage? Or what do we do with the dog? Do we blast music in the house? I know we had, I've had two dogs. One of them had the PTSD thing going. The other one just doesn't bat an eye. Some of them don't.
Yeah, it's weird. Some of them really don't care. Others, they start shaking and drooling and losing their minds. And it's really a shame.
But. Well, I was an unlicensed pyrotechnic when I was younger.
a lot of young people are.
A lot of people, when I was 12, me and my friends lighting off those, you know, nothing crazy, just those little firecrackers or whatever, but man, that was fun. Is there anything, I guess, just to kind of put a bow on that part of this conversation is, I mean, what are kind of the main steps that maybe you guys take in the gorge or just in general that we could take as a public to try to help prevent, or at least reduce or catch those wildfires quicker, maybe, so that something like what happened a couple summers ago doesn't happen again?
Well, really what we're finding and what the forest ecologists and the experts who are studying wildfires and the impacts on communities are showing is that really in terms of mitigating impacts to people and our homes is really within about 100 feet of buildings and homes. So if you're talking about an area that's outside of that parameter, you pretty much don't have to worry about it. Most of the fires that burn down people's homes and dwellings or other buildings are from not the fire directly. It's from the ember storm, they call it, which is the embers that float on the wind and settle like in people's gutters. The number one thing that leads to a house burning down is a clogged gutter. Because embers fall in it and they set that tinder on fire, and that's what burns the house down.
Wow.
So fireproofing your home, if you live in a fire-prone area, that's by far the best thing you can do to ensure that your property gets protected, is just being what they call fire safe.
Okay.
There's lots of guidelines out there to help you with that.
Okay.
Just look up fire safe online.
We have like 4 minutes left here.
Oh,
so
boy.
I know we got going on some tangents.
There's a lot to talk about.
But I know you wanted to talk about what you've been working on for the last 6 years or so, the oil and coal trains and terminals in the Portland area and how you think that's affecting the environment. Go ahead and talk to us about that.
Yeah, I'll try to wrap up 6 years in just a few minutes. first and foremost, Friends is a conservation group. And so we've been a part of two big coalitions in the last 6 years called the Power Past Coal Coalition and the Stand Up to Oil Coalitions. And those are some of the biggest environmental coalitions I've ever seen or been a part of, really. They've been nonprofit groups and individuals, tribes, Native American tribes, and elected officials all throughout British Columbia, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. And the goal of these has been to stop what were new proposals to bring large oil and coal export facilities to the West Coast. And there were 12 of them in total over the last 6 years. And thankfully, the coalitions stopped all 12 of them. So it was a huge environmental success. But in that process, we were kind of keeping our eye out for what would the oil companies do next. And what's happening now is one of the things we expected, which is they're looking at existing old facilities that they can buy and sort of retrofit. And instead of having to get a whole new permit, they just amend an existing permit for an existing facility. And they're able to switch the operations of that facility over to exporting crude oil. And that's what's happening right here in Portland. There's a number of facilities that they're trying to do this with throughout the Northwest, but there's one right here in Portland called Zenith, and it's right down in the industrial park in North Portland. It used to be an asphalt facility, so that they used to just mix up asphalt there. But they have all these large holding tanks. So an oil company came in because I forget what Zenith was called. Was it Arc Logistics? Something like that. When they were making asphalt, and they kind of stopped making asphalt, and the facility had been lying dormant. So this oil company came in, bought it up, and they want to turn all those holding tanks into crude oil holding tanks and simply act as a way station to bring in oil chains down through the Columbia Gorge, through Portland, and offload them and put them on ships and probably ship the crude oil overseas to Asia. Now, why is this a problem? Well, none of this crude oil is needed for domestic consumption, certainly not local consumption. And this oil is typically coming from one of two places, either the tar sands in Canada, in Alberta, Canada, or the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota, which is obtained through hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, as they call it. And a lot of people might have heard of that before with methane gas fracking. They can also do it with petroleum. And this isn't normal crude oil like with the Beverly Hillbillies shooting a bullet in the ground and it bubbling up to the surface. With hydraulic fracturing, they have to pump this chemical mixture of high pressured water mixed with all these toxic additives underground, deep underground, and they create these micro earthquakes where they frack apart shale formations, and that releases massive amounts of propane, butane, and petroleum. And they collect all that and then put it in these tanker cars and ship it out this way. Well, that mix of fossil fuels has much more propane and butane in it than typical normal crude oil. And that's been causing these trains, when they derail, when there's an accident, to not just spill oil, which is bad enough, but oftentimes, most of the time, these oil tankers blow up. And we saw that happen in Canada in, I think it was 2013, in Lac Megantic. And that derailment happened right in the middle of a town, and the train was moving really fast. So most of the train cars blew up, and it leveled the entire town and downtown area, and it killed 47 people. Wow. And we had our own disaster here in the gorge out in Mosier, Oregon. Luckily, nobody was killed in that one because the train wasn't moving very quickly, and so the cars didn't explode. They just leaked their contents, and they caught on fire. But if that train had been moving much faster, they probably would have started blowing up the cars. The school was only about 400 feet from where the derailment happened, and school was in session. They had to evacuate the whole town of Mosier. It shut down I-5 for the whole day, and it was just a disaster, but it could have been much worse. So we really are concerned about that product. Also, the tar sands in Canada, that stuff typically doesn't explode, but it's a much, much dirtier form of oil. It's what it sounds like. It's this tarry, sand-like substance that's incredibly difficult to mine and process, uses a lot of energy in the process of extracting it, and it's much more pollutive and toxic than typical crude oil. So we don't want either coming through this area. There's a lot of people in the Portland community upset about this, talking to city council. I encourage everybody to get involved. The mayor is listening to us as the city council, and they want to try to figure out a way to say no to this new infrastructure development for these dirtier forms of oil. They've already actually passed an ordinance against new fossil fuel infrastructure, but the concern is that since this was an existing facility, that maybe it's going to weasel its way around that ordinance. So they're trying to figure out a legal way to apply that ordinance to this facility, and we just need to keep spreading awareness and keep getting pressure where it's required so that we can prevent this new investment in dirtier forms of fossil fuel.
Yeah. Where do we stand right now in the battle between those who are doing good and trying to protect the environment and those who are seeking money through basically oil manufacturing and then sending it off to Asia, like you were saying earlier? I mean, are you guys not in court against each other, I guess, but how does that work, and where are we at in like kind of the battle?
Right. Well, and you know, don't get me wrong. Like I said, we've been successful at stopping 12 brand new giant proposals. So it's not all bad news. Mm-hmm. So we're forcing the fossil fuel companies to take more and more drastic measures and get more and more creative with what they're trying to do. And that's a good sign. Mm-hmm. But in terms of this specific one, we are right now talking to the city council of Portland. Mm-hmm. They've said they're going to set up a public workshop on this issue. issue where people will be able to public comment. I don't have a date or a time yet on that, but try to stay tuned. If you want to stay in the loop on that, go to our website and sign up for our action alerts. We have a number of different alerts you can get, like hiking or monthly news or my action alerts that I send out personally. And I'll let people know through that alert email system when that public workshop happens. So please come, please attend. There's also lawyers that work for the coalition organizations, of which Friends is only one, that are working very hard with the city and trying to figure out what the legal options are to challenge Zenith and the oil companies behind it.
Cool. Well, Ryan, thank you very much for coming in. I know that we could have asked even more. I guess you guys have an event. Maybe we can ask you about that really quickly. The 39th annual Picnic in Paradise coming up Sunday, June 23rd. In Cascade Locks, Oregon. I was on your guys' event calendar. And again, for people who are interested, gorgefriends.org is the website. You can basically learn more about what Ryan and I have been discussing, and then also check out their events calendar on there. I know you guys just had an event recently, the Gorge on Tap, earlier this June. But yeah, some summer events that you guys have coming up, maybe particularly the Picnic in Paradise, if you want to just take a chance and tell people what they could expect if they attend that.
Yeah, great. Yeah, we hold one every year, and we do a lot of other events. Gorge on Tap, we hold four times a year. The next one will be out in the Dalles, I believe, and then we have one in Portland in the fall. But yeah, the Picnic in Paradise, come on out next Sunday and hang out with us. Bring your picnic basket with your lunch. We'll provide some beer and dessert.
Ooh, nice.
And we will provide live music as well.
Wow.
We used to do short talks, but I think we're scaling back on that. We do talks at Gorge on Tap where we talk about, like I did here, mm-hmm. policy and updates. But at the Picnic, we're trying to get more laid back. But there'll be information tables there where you can find out more about what we do. We do a lot. I'm the conservation organizer, but we have all kinds of stuff that we do, not just the hiking program and at the Land Trust. But we have a vision called Gorge Towns to Trails of building a linking loop hike system that goes throughout the entire gorge someday. We're doing all kinds of stuff. So yeah, come out, meet us, meet our, maybe become a member yourself and enjoy a beautiful picnic and beautiful Cascade Locks. It should be a great day.
You sold me. I'm absolutely sold. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
We were talking today with Ryan Rittenhouse from Friends of the Columbia Gorge. Metroscope is an Entercom Portland Public Affairs program. I'm Preston Highfield. If you're involved with a nonprofit or public affairs organization, or if you have an idea for an upcoming show, I'd like to hear from you. Visit metroscopepdx.com and submit your ideas. You can also go to the station's website and submit your information there. Thanks for listening to Metroscope and enjoy the rest of your weekend.
I'm caught up in the game. My attention is on every play and every whistle. But what I'm missing is a signal coming from my kidneys. That signal isn't like a ref's whistle. It's more of a silent SOS, which could be warning me of an increased risk for events like heart attack or stroke. And a way I can catch that signal? A simple urine test called UACR. If you have type 2 diabetes or high blood pressure, talk to your doctor about the UACR test. Detect the SOS. Visit detectthesos.com to learn more.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Get smoother, brighter skin instantly in one easy step. Dermalogica's Daily Microfoliant gives you the smooth, glowy skin you want without damaging your skin barrier. This gentle exfoliating powder activates with water to smooth out rough texture and brighten skin. It's powerful enough to deliver results, yet gentle enough to use every single day, even on sensitive skin. See the results for yourself. Visit Dermalogica.com and use code SMOOTH at cart for an exclusive free gift with $65 purchase.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Think advertising on TikTok isn't for your business? Think again.
We've generated over 100,000 leads, which has converted into over 40,000 sales for our pet insurance policies. My name is Trey Farrow. I am the CEO of Spot Pet Insurance. TikTok's Smart Plus AI-powered automation takes the guesswork out of targeting, bidding, and optimizing creative. If I can advertise on TikTok, you can too.
Drive more leads and scale your business today, only on TikTok. Head over to getstarted.tiktok.com/TikTok ads.